Before I start, I guess I'd like to say that wisdom is the judgment of the perceiver. So it's up to you. Namaste.
Namaste.
The God in me greets the God in you. I've given the Father's Day talk at the temple before, and today I'm going to give a little different twist on it. But my father, Hamilton G. Shoon, was born here in Tucson in 1911. And he grew up during the Depression. Very rough years, one of nine children. And it was hard scrabble times. And yet during that time, he worked his way through one of the better schools in the United States, paid his own way, University of Southern California, became a civil engineer, was a two-time national Chinese tennis champion, and worked hard. As was his sign. He was a Capricorn. In 1945, much to his amazement, he gave birth to me, an Aquarian, who could not understand the natural inclinations of Capricorns, who could not understand the natural inclinations of Aquarians. Well, my father died in the year 2000, and that was the year Martha and I moved from the San Francisco Bay Area to Tucson. And in 2005, a friend of ours who we had met the year before showed us Martha these pictures, these little card pictures. She said happened during a seance with her friend Hoyt Robinette from Camp Chesterfield. And Hoyt Robinette had told her that he was going to be in Tucson. And she said, you guys should see this guy. And Martha, we were going to Los Angeles that weekend, and so Martha said, well, we can't, we're out of town. But when she was seeing the little cards, the spirit cards that Pat Gallinet showed her, Martha said, I want to meet this guy. I mean, she had been told that Hoyt Robinette, the medium, would put blank cards in a little sealed woven basket in front of him with gel pens and colored pens with the caps on. And then he'd give a talk, he'd tape his eyes, give a talk, and give everybody a message. And then at the end of that time, probably 40 minutes later, he'd take the tape off, open his eyes, take the lid off the box, and everyone would have a card with a picture on it and the names of who in spirit were there. When Martha saw this, she said, I want to meet him. 2 months later, we found ourselves in Scottsdale at a condominium. Hoyt was there on a weekend doing his, quote, magic. He really is an extraordinary medium. And Martha was the first one to go in and see him. And what you do when you see Hoyt, when you have a private, is you write down the names of people in spirit, people who have crossed over, parents, friends, whatever, spirit guides. And then you write down five questions, and then you sign your name. And then you hand it to Hoyt. Well, Martha went in before me, and she was walking back down. She had a look on her face I could not believe when it was my turn. I had never seen a look on her face before. Later, she told me that her father had taken Hoyt's body over and spoke to her for a half hour and answered every question she had by the number. Not knowing this, I walked in, sat down, there's Hoyt sitting in front of me, and I handed him my piece of paper. Hoyt never reads these, holds them in his hand. And he looks at me and he said, there's a May here. I said, that's my mother. And then he said, there's a Hamilton. I said, that's my father. Then he said, he wants me to know he's a part of this project. Now, I had never seen or heard of the project before, and I didn't know what he was talking about. But I knew my life had been very unusual, and it might be a part of that. So what I want to do is read part of my bio up until the time that we saw Hoyt in 2006. So you will realize, too, my strange journey up until that time. I'd been in 1945 20 years later, I wrote a play. I'm the UC Davis. The play was produced at the YMYWCA Western Convocation and later on the campus at the University of California, Davis. That year, I was appointed to the Student Faculty Liaison Committee over the riots that were happening across the UC system over the Vietnam War. The next year, and that year I was a chairman of the Students for Political and Social Action, the local radical club on campus. The next year I was a first year student at Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. And my friend Marshall, who I had met, said he wanted me to write an article for the law school newspaper. And I did. Marshall in January put it on the front page of the Hastings Voir dire, and the article headline was, Church Liable for Acts of God. An article in which I argued that if natural disaster happened, all you had to do was walk down to your local church, hand them the bill, and they should pay up. After all, they were legally recognized as agents of God on our planet. The dean saw this and threatened to expel Marshall from law school and shut down the student government if the newspaper went out. It didn't go out. I dropped out of law school, and the next year I was running the food concessions at the Avalon Ballroom in San Francisco. Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Yes.
And when Marshall's, and when the law school class was graduating, I was in San Francisco County Jail for selling LSD. What is not in my bio is before I was arrested, probably which happened in March or April of that year, in February 17th, and you could see it, if you Google the name, Celestial Synapse, there was a concert or gathering in San Francisco. It was invitation only. 1,500 invitations were sent out. Probably 3,000 people attended. It was put on by the Celestial, by the Harbingers of Sun Foundation, a commune in Northern California. The Grateful Dead was the only band on, and they played for 4 hours. Yeah. It was astounding. There was more acid dropped in that room per capita than I can believe. In the middle of the concert, when they had left the stage, Steve Gasson got up with his conch shell and started blowing the shell. And a Monday night class, which was our church in the Haight-Ashbury, we knew it was time to own. And we owned 3,000 of us, by this time mainly naked hippies, chanting, we are all one. We are all one. And that went on for hours until the Grateful Dead came back on. And that morning, I remember leaving that event, walking into the dawn of San Francisco. It was still, cars weren't on the streets, and I heard the voice. And the voice said, this is over. It is time to take it out into the world. A month later, I was arrested, did 45 days for selling acid. In my defense, there was no defense. The tabs were red, white, and blue with peace signs on the ends of them. The next year, this is back in my bio again, I had a restaurant in Berkeley, Great Shanghai Steel and Iron Works. We were very successful for the first year and a half until we decided to go vegetarian and we went broke. This is not in my bio. Marshall then called me up and he told me he had a book he wanted me to read. It's called Lazy Man's Way to Riches. Marshall wasn't lazy, he was an Aries, but he certainly wanted to get rich. So he handed me the book. It was a book on affirmations. Marshall had his list, I had my list. 3 years later, Marshall had a Rolls Royce, was living in a mansion next to Dianne Feinstein, and was on the cover of New Age magazine. And I was a retired drug dealer with a whole lot of cash. This is not in the bio. In 1976, I'm sitting in my apartment in San Francisco, and I hear the voice again. And the voice said, this isn't it. I wasn't disturbed because I heard a voice. I was disturbed because I thought that I was supposed to give up. Now I had a Carnegie Hall, Marshall Rolls Royce, but I had a lot of money. I was now eating in restaurants. Life was good for the first time. Life wasn't chaotic. And I was afraid that it meant I had to give it up. So in my nervousness, I closed my eyes and I asked what I now know to be it, the impersonal life, God, the higher self. And I asked, what is it? And I waited, and the answer came to me in a feeling of deep, deep peace. A peace that I can only describe as crickets going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And I was on the side of a mountain, and it was dark. And across the valley, there was a cabin with a fire in it. And I knew that was my cabin. And I wasn't home, but it didn't matter. I was completely at peace. So I thought, if affirmations had brought me everything I wanted, I started writing affirmations about peace. I remember one I stole from Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I am everywhere at once. I did that every morning, every night. And I remember looking at that, what the hell are you thinking of? I am everywhere at once. I mean, it didn't make sense to me, but I did that with peace, with all my affirmations. And 2 months later, at Marshall's law office, his real estate office now, a couple came in with a book. And they said, we know that you're working with affirmations. And the affirmation we're working with today is called, I am entitled to miracles. I went up to him after the class and I said, where did this book come from? They said it was just published this month. I opened it up. It said, this is A Course in Miracles. It is a manual for peace. My affirmations come true. What's back in the bio is that I went to China that year, and I formed a import-export company, started importing Chinese Oriental rugs. 2 years later, our company was on the front page of the business section of the San Francisco Chronicle. I met that year with the board of directors of McDonnell Douglas to discuss a possible offset deal with jet aircraft in the People's Republic of China. And in January of 1979, I had presidential invitations from the White House to attend the reception for the Vice Premier of China, Deng Xiaoping, in Washington, D.C. 2 years after that, this is still in the bio, I was with Dianne Feinstein. We went to Shanghai. And I delivered an address before the heads of state trading organizations and the mayor of Shanghai, where I gave my recommendations on how to improve U.S.-China trade. I'm not saying I'm responsible for what happened, but my talk was significant enough that Dianne came to me after the next morning and acknowledged the impact of what I had said. That was 1982. 1983, I designed a series of acid tabs with Dr. Albert Hoffman on them that made it into Ripley's Believe It or Not and in a museum of LSD tabs later. And then that year I heard words, the year after. And these words, the voice again. And the voice said this, your use of thought to create your reality is inappropriate use of this power at this time. Because at this time, much of what you learn comes through adversity. And you are using this power to keep these learning situations that you need away from you. Holy smokes. I had no answer for that voice, for what it said. But, so I threw the I Ching. Should I stop doing my affirmations? It said yes. I asked the inner self, should I stop doing affirmations? It said yes. 2 years later, I was arrested by the DEA, sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. This is in my bio. What is not in my bio is on my way to federal prison, waist-chained, manacled, and handcuffed, getting out of a prison van in Sacramento, California, where I had grown up. I recognized the library. Looking out the van, I heard the voice again. And the voice said, you're going to meet someone here. And I did. And due to that person, 2 weeks later, I was not sitting in the county jail for months, which is the usual. I was at Lompoc Federal Prison Camp, what I called later the penalty box of the stars. They had a tennis court. Ehrlichman and Haldeman were sent there. And a week later, I met the former banker to Howard Hughes, who told me a story of a $500 million scheme from the Reagan White House with the CIA to defraud the royal Saudi family of $500 million that they had donated to the Afghan cause of resistance in Afghanistan. He told me that story because he was going to try and blackmail the White House to reduce his sentence. Norton believed he had been in fairly prison because they wanted to shut him up because of what he knew. It didn't work. And when Norman got out, he told me to forget the story. But I had it. And I had all the documents that Norman had given me. So what I did then is I wrote a little collection called Betrayal. And I sent it out to the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times, Washington Post, telling them of meeting Norman Bernard Thierry and what he had told me, and would they be interested? I heard no response. Later in my prison sentence, I meditated so much, and this is in my bio, I had an experience of oneness. And right before I got out, I heard the voice. I didn't hear the voice again. The voice came to me with words describing a cataclysmic economic collapse called the time of the vulture. That was in 1991. I got out of prison in 91. This is in my bio. And not in my bio, in 2004, I decide to phone a professor of economics at the University of Southern California about what Norman had told me about the CIA White House scheme. His name was Professor Nate Kamrani. And Norman said he didn't believe Dr. Kamrani was involved in the scheme. He was just an Afghan patriot who was used like he was to get the money. So I hadn't talked to anybody, so I called him up. I emailed him. I got an immediate phone call. What are you talking about? There was no scheme. Why are you even dealing with this? I said, I'm writing a book. I wasn't writing a book, but I had to tell him something. I said, but I knew Dr. Norman Bernard Thurian, who was Howard Hughes' banker. And he told me a bunch of things that happened back then. And he said, yeah, there was no blah, 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 blah. Then he goes out amazingly. Professor Kamrani goes, do you know anybody in the movie business? 2 months before, I would have said no. But as coincidence has it, I said yes. Because Marshall's son, Rawson Marshall Thurber, had just written and directed his first movie, Dodgeball. And Marshall had rented a movie theater in Los Angeles for us to attend the premiere. Martha and I were going. So I said, yes, I do know somebody in the movie business. He said, could we meet? His son had graduated from film school and wanted a gig. So Martha and I met with Professor Kamrani after the premiere. Great, great movie if you haven't seen it. And confirmed to me many of the things that Norman told me about. So I had confirmation about what really had happened. Well, that was in 2004. In 2005, before I met Hoyt, I entered the Austin Songwriters contest and took first and third places. And that brings us up to meeting Hoyt, when he said, my father wants to know that you to know that he wants me to know that he's a part of this project. And that's why I took note, because my life had definitely, up to that point, been highly unusual. And so the next thing that Hoyt said was, you're a teacher. And I said, no. He said, you teach. I said, no. I'm blowing him off. Clearly, he's hearing something from spirit. Right, so I think. And then he says, you know things that other people don't know. And I said, everybody thinks that. But I have no voice, no audience, and no agreement. And the next thing that Hoyt Robinette said, this will soon change. People will begin seeking you out. 2 years later, I delivered a talk at Marshall's Positive Deviant Network in which I predicted a severe economic crash, collapse of currencies, and I called it Time of the Vulture. A year later, I was lecturing in Hungary at a gold conference. 4 years later, my website had visitors from all around the world, and I was a speaker and writer on topics of gold and the economic crisis. And in 2011, if you had Googled my name, there was over 60 pages of links on Google to my name. Hoyt's prediction had come true. But nonetheless, I still had no idea what the project he was talking about. And it perplexed me. And now today, I have an inkling, not about the project, but what I'm supposed to do. I think there is a project. I think my life is a part of it, as was my father's, as is a whole lot of people. But I don't know what that project is. But I have the feeling that my part in the project is merely to do and to say what I'm prompted to do and say. Whether it's words about an economic crash, whether it's words talking about the metaphysics of the ascension of what's going on now, that's all. And so a part of that, I want to read words that I've been reading about what we're about to go into. And it came from a book that I ran into probably 15 years ago called Christ's Letters. In the early 2000s, 9 letters were transcribed through a woman who claimed that it was Jesus talking to her directly, whose story was that she had met domestic difficulties in the 1990s when she was younger, and this voice had come to her and led her through all the difficulties with an unerring comfort and direction. And the voice identified itself as Jesus. And then Jesus had her, after intense preparation, transcribe 9 letters that he said were important for this time. Now, if you Google and ask AI about Christ's letters, it'll tell you. Oh, yes, there were 9 letters allegedly came from the historical Jesus, blah, 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 blah. And it said, but there's a lot of controversy about this. Most of the people believe that this is false. The teachings are not true, and it's written merely to make money. And it said that even though the letters are free on the internet. Now you can buy the book. Now I read those letters years ago, but because of the situation that we're facing right now, for some reason, I started rereading them a couple of months ago. And in fact, in April, Martha and Yazdi and I were back at Camp Chesterfield. And we're in another circle with Hoyt. More cards. And on the names that you write down of people in spirit, for the first time, I wrote down Jesus. Why? Because I was rereading Christ's letters. And when Hoyt went around, came to me, he goes, named all the people in my cards, my father, my mother, and he says, and Jesus is here. Well, that's interesting. And so what I want to do is I want to take this time to read you something from the fourth letter. Something from the fourth letter that he talked about. But on his website, that's what it comes. Okay, I'm going to back up and go to, because I Googled his website this morning, of Christ's letters. And it said this: we have now reached the time that Christ came with his letters to prepare us for the end of a long spiritual session that has been prophesied for eons in all the great spiritual texts. As Christ tells us, the purpose of my presence, the Christ presence, within these letters, is to reach sensitive and inspired souls, to teach them how to draw on divine assistance during the future horror in which the world will ultimately be embroiled. It is now urgent that each soul be prepared for the disclosure of long hidden secrets and increasing chaos that will serve to clear the darkness and bring in the light. The future horror Christ came to warn us about is now here, and simply stated, you have 2 choices, and only 2 choices. Do you choose to continue in the dark, caught up in the material world and trapped in the illusion of separation, fearing, judging, and not forgiving others or yourself, and not accepting responsibility for what you have created? Or do you choose the light, love, and unity, Christ's way? The first choice leads to a continuation of the reincarnation cycle, and the second choice leads to the end of the reincarnation cycle and physical ascension to the 5th dimension, the end of separation and suffering. My boundless celestial love impels me to return again and again to write to mankind with my intention that finally, as many of you who are ready to receive it will possess the knowledge which will enable you to transcend your humanhood and merge into Father consciousness, the true love consciousness in which we are, in which all are realized, all things bountiful and beautiful. Because the wrong interpretations had been placed on my mission by Jewish teachers, my true message has been distorted out of recognition. And the purpose of these letters is to bring to the people of this new age the truth of what I really spoke to the crowds in Palestine. I suggest that if you don't want to buy the book, Christ's Letters, you go on the internet. I mean, in 2026, you don't hear about these books. But you do hear about Christian nationalism in Charlie Kirk. You do hear about the fights between the Muslims and the born-again Christians and the conflict. But let me tell you, those are elements of the age of which is disappearing. And what Christ says are tenets that we hold dear in the temple of universality. That each of us is a creator. That each of us is a co-creator with others of the creation in which we are experiencing. And if you want your creation to be what you want it to be, you're going to have to change what you are seeing and thinking. Most of us, I would say, in this room have been on that path for years. Rather than seeing conflict, we try and see love. Rather than judging others, we try and accept somehow that person's right to be and think those God-awful thoughts. And we're trying. God knows we're trying. But I think push is coming to shove. And I think it's now time, and we're on the edge of those times, of where we either remain creating the past chaos or truly become the co-creators of the paradise and the new earth that God is ordained to be here. The Temple of Universality was given a special mission in 1995 through Betty Tadlewski, and has brought us all together. And one of the tenets of that is that there's truth in all religions. And in Christ's letters, God says that. He talks to the churches and tells them in no uncertain terms they had better get off the toilet if they want to be on the ark. He talks to all those still judging. It's time to clean up your judgments about yourself and others. These are the end times which were prophesied. Now, I'm not saying that this morning, because there were three hippies on the Temple of Universality, that's the sign of the end times. Howard Milwich from the East Coast, Martha from the Midwest, and I from the West Coast. But you could say that. Today I have witnessed with my own eyes signs of the end times. Or you may choose not to say that. There's plenty of other evidence. And with that, I leave you, my brothers and sisters. Namaste.